So I'm Neil Barenberg. Thank you for all coming. I'll be moderating today's session. We want to give thanks to the Harry H. Barron's Trust and Rev Zev Barron for its continuing sponsorship of Torah for Tycoons. Torah for Tycoons is celebrating its bar mitzvah year, 13th year. Throughout the past 12 seasons, the Kohel has brought the Torah perspective on business and personal ethics to well over 500 people through this program. The next class will be on Wednesday, June 7th, entitled Tough Love, Dealing with a Difficult Parent. Will feature psychotherapist Ari Hoffman and Kohel senior educator Rabbi Mordechai Fleischer. Kohel is holding a Charity with a D fundraising campaign in less than 1 week. This coming Tuesday, the Kohel is raising $300,000 in 24 hours to help fund the Kohel's many programs and events that take place throughout the greater Denver area. Every dollar you give is quadrupled thanks to three generous matchers. And for more information, speak to a Kohel person. You may notice on the tables a flyer advertising a Kohel Learn-a-thon. In its second year, this unique and exciting event will be held by the Kohel and in several weeks' time on May 28th. The event will feature the study and completion of an entire tractate of Talmud, 18 folios, in the course of 1 hour of Torah study, followed by a short siyum ceremony and celebration. This is a great way to get ready for the holiday of Shavuos, which is a few days later, and there is no charge to participate. Speak to Kohel person for more details. If you missed a past Torah for Tycoon classes, you may want to listen to recordings. You can find them on the Kohel's website. You can also find the latest information on Kohel programming and archived classes on many topics on the website. Now I'd like to introduce our today's presenters, Scott Levin, a regional director of the ADL, and Rabbi Mordechai Fleischer, senior educator for the Denver Community Kohel. Scott?
Thank you. Well, it's a pleasure to be here and to be back, to be on this side of the table. Congratulations, Rabbi Schwab, on your bar mitzvah again, and I'm glad to see that it's coming up to 13 years. I've been the regional director of the Anti-Defamation League now for about 6.5 years, and it has truly been an interesting time, especially during this past year and a half, when we've seen just a dramatic increase in anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism in 2016, according to the records that we keep on incidents that have happened in Colorado, show that there were 2.5 times more anti-Semitic incidents during 2016 than there were in 2015. And that translates into the fact that in 2015, we had about 10 incidents. I'm sorry, 2014, we had 10 incidents. 2015, we had 18 incidents. And last year, we had 45 incidents. This year, during the first quarter of the year, we measured 15 incidents. So if that goes on, if we were to keep on that trajectory and had 60 by the end of the year, we'd be at 3 times as many as what we had had in 2015. So this is an increase that nobody wants to see and with which we really have a lot of work to do. And so I'm very glad to be able to speak to you about it today. This isn't happening just in Colorado. We've also measured across our 27 offices that we have in the United States dramatic increases. They haven't all been quite as much as they've been here in Colorado. Some of that might be that in some of the bigger states where there are more Jews that are there, such as in New York and California, New Jersey, Massachusetts, Florida, they already had a lot of incidents. So the increase may not be measured quite as great as we've had it here. But across the country, it's been about 36% increase year over year. The types of incidents that have been going on here in Colorado, thank goodness, of those 45 incidents, there unfortunately was one assault. And I say thank goodness it was only one assault that was there. But most of the incidences are vandalism. And it can be of the type of the brick that was thrown through the synagogue window at the Chabad house that took place, graffiti, a lot of swastikas that have been put up of that nature, swastikas that have been etched in people's cars. A few of them you might remember last spring in the Virginia Vale neighborhood. And one night there was pretty much terrorism on a block where there was painting in the street. There was painting on people's garage doors. There was painting and etching on people's cars that had very awful anti-Jewish language that was going on. We've had, and it can range from that type of activity that would actually be a hate crime under our bias-motivated statutes that we have in Colorado. If your motivation for committing the crime is because of the fact of somebody's race, religion, color, sexual identity, nation of origin, and the other protected classes that go on, if that can be proven that that's why you did the action, not just because you wanted to get into Danny Woodrow's wallet because you know it's so thick, but you're going against him because he's Jewish and you want to send a message that Jews like Danny Woodrow are not acceptable in our community, that would be a bias-motivated statute or bias-motivated crime. But there's also anti-Semitic incidents. So, you know, these aren't the graffiti, they aren't the vandalism, they're not the assault. They're the kind of situation, the one that sort of comes to my mind and breaks my heart is the 83-year-old woman who walks out of Costco this past December, and in the snow on her car, somebody with just their finger, so it didn't do permanent damage, draws a swastika and puts below it the word Jew. You know, as she said, how did they know my car was Jewish, right? But the reality is how vulnerable that people can be made to feel with that kind of incident that happens, those kinds of attacks that go on. In the ADL world, we think that you can't really manage or do something about this if you're not measuring it. So it's really important to us that we keep these metrics, and we get them because people call in, we provide assistance to them. We work very closely with law enforcement on all types of hate crimes, but especially anti-Semitism. And we obviously track what's going on, as a lot of people do in the media and otherwise. Some people have asked, you know, why these increases, what's happening. And some people will draw a really quick line and say that, you know, there's been obviously some rhetoric that's going on at the national level that is not, what would that be, right? And the reality is that, well, I don't believe that Donald Trump has ever called for an act of anti-Semitism. And while his word choice may not be the one that's the best that I would like, there has been an emboldenment of some people to be able to act on, I think, some anti-Semitism that's always been there. One of the other things that ADL does is every 2 years we do a survey across the United States, and actually a few years ago we started doing it in 100 countries across the world, where we measure anti-Semitic attitudes. And the way that we do this is that we give the same 10 statements that we've been giving since the mid-1960s. And if a respondent answers affirmative to a majority of them, to six of those statements, then they're deemed to have anti-Semitic attitudes. Any one of these statements will curl your hair. You know, Jews control the world. Jews always want to be the heads of things. Jews care more about Israel than they do any, you know, the country. Jews control finances, the movies, those kind of things. So you have to answer 6 out of 10 of those to be deemed an anti-Semite. I asked my former national director, Abe Foxman, you know, this great pugnacious of a guy that nobody was going to give any stuff to. I said, why did you pick 6? I said, if somebody would have said yes to any one of those, I would probably think they had an anti-Semitic attitude. And Abe said, well, in the mid-1960s when they started doing it, if they didn't set the threshold at 6, the entire country would have been anti-Semitic. And instead, in the mid-1960s, they were at about 35, 36% of the country that answered the majority of those as being in the affirmative and therefore were deemed to be anti-Semitic. Today, we're down to 13, 14%. And we think we've made a lot of progress. You know, clearly going from a third of the country down to that is a good thing until you think about how large this country is and how many people really carry those kind of attitudes that are with them. The good news, I will tell you, is over the last few years, as we've measured it, anti-Semitic attitudes have remained basically flat. within a couple percentage of each other. It's the incidence of anti-Semitism, these acts of vandalism, these acts of anti-Semitic intimidation that have taken place, those have gone up. So what seems to be happening is while probably the anti-Semites haven't gotten to be more in number, they've become more emboldened, those that are, to act out. And so I just wanted to finish with the question of today's topic is what are we going to do with anti-Semitism? How do we approach that from going on? This is an age-old problem. Doctor was saying before man was created, anti-Semitism existed. Clearly, at least for 2,000 years, the advent of the Christian church was a pretty big indicator of it, because deicide, the allegation that you killed my God, can be a pretty big deal to people as a motivating factor. But I don't want to take a lot of the time going through the history. We know a lot about the history of where we're at. But the question is how do you counter that? The Anti-Defamation League has been in Denver now since 1941. So for more than 75 years. We've been in the country since 1913. So more than 100 years. We've had the same mission the entire time. And that's to stop the defamation of the Jewish people. They didn't have the word anti-Semitism yet in 1913. So that's the way they defined it. And to secure justice and fair treatment to all. And so from my perspective, it's really the embodiment of the Pirkei Avot in 1:14, where Hillel says, if I'm not for myself, who will be for me? But if I'm only for myself, what am I? And if not now, when? So I think it's really a reflection that we need to be, first and foremost, standing up for ourselves, that our best safety and security comes from the work that we do in making it a safer country or a safer world for all. And there's no time like the present to start that. It's also, I was also reminded, Pirkei Avot 2:5, Al Tifrash Min Hatzibur, you know, don't separate yourself from the community. It's that involvement that we can do. So for us, at the Anti-Defamation League, we work in coalition with a lot of the other organizations that have been attacked in our parts of hate. In January, I formed an organization called Mountain States Against Hate, where I have 20 organizations coming based on all of those protective classes that are out there that are all facing hate. Because the thought is that we can speak more loudly and use the leverage of a greater organization to speak than we can just by ourselves. Another thing that we do is we work very, very closely with law enforcement. We're the largest non-governmental trainer of police officers in the country. And the way we got to do that is that ADL was the organization that developed and advocated for hate crimes laws, those bias-motivated kind of crimes, to be adopted in the country. And right now they're in 45 states out of the 50, unfortunately not in Wyoming. They're in a lot of municipalities. As of this morning, I was just testifying at the city council right before I got here. They're looking at putting it there. And on the national level, we have a Federal Hate Crimes Act, the Matthew Shepard James Byrd Jr. Federal Hate Crimes Law. So when we train them about that, we also have a group of people who are, we call them investigative researchers. But mainly what they do is they monitor the bad guys. We've got about a half dozen people planted across the country. They keep tabs on the white supremacists, neo-Nazis, KKK on the right, and some of the people that are on the left right now that are expressing their anti-Semitism. And believe me, you know, police officers, for instance, can't go on to social media like Facebook and just troll around looking for bad guys because they need probable cause and a warrant. But an investigative researcher from the New York Times or from the ADL can do that and share that information, and law enforcement likes that. That exchange of information that we have also means that I have the cell phone numbers of most of the chiefs of police in the Denver metropolitan area, and I can call them when there's a problem that occurs in the Jewish world. The other thing that we do is we work closely with our political leaders. I don't know if anybody here was there, but just a week ago we had the governor's Holocaust Remembrance Program. There were 1,700 people that were there. And it's important because while government was the perpetrator of the worst destruction in our lives and in many generations in the Jewish world through the Holocaust, we want government to be able to speak up and speak out against those types of things. So we call on them to do that, and that, I think, provides some comfort and is good for our people as well. And then the final thing is that what we advocate for, and we call on everybody to do, again, is to identify anti-Semitism when it happens, call it out, make sure that the media is aware of it. I was on my drive here from City Council to hear, "This is my life." You might have seen, but last night, it could have been in the early morning the night before, across from the Hillel at the University of Denver, there were a couple of cars that were etched with swastikas and KKK that was put in them. So we always have to measure and think about. Sometimes we don't go to the press or the media. We don't make it public because we don't want to give a forum to the bad guys that are out there. That's what they're kind of looking for. But sometimes we have to make the decision that it's important to identify it, label it, and speak out on it so that we can get our neighbors and our community and the non-Jewish world to also condemn that. And then it's better for us. And with that, I'm going to turn it. Oh, I'm sorry. You want to wait or do you want to? Somebody had a question.
Oh,
they had that on TV at 11 o'clock.
Last night?
This morning, maybe last night, that there were these cars.
Yeah.
And they weren't, I don't think, all Jewish, because the woman they interviewed, she wasn't Jewish, that they got. But they were near the Hillel. But what I was going to say is about, I don't know if it's been a year yet, or not, there was this vehicle driving around the different temple, Emmanuel, Edo, Chabad, and all that, which an individual, a woman who was taking pictures of Edo's, and you're now, so is the ADL monitoring this?
Yeah. I'm
very
familiar.
Hold questions until after.
Yeah. I was just saying that I'm very familiar with that situation. Yeah, we did very much do that as well. Thank you.
Well, Scott, thank you for that presentation. We would like to be optimistic here, but the concern for me, and I'm sure others, is that this is part of our culture and part of the culture of the world for the last 2,000 years. And I would like to learn how, if that ever can be altered and why it occurred in the first place besides genocide. So, Rabbi Fleischer,
okay.
We'll get more from you.
Thank you very much, Scott. Thank you, Dr. Barenberg. I think Dr. Barenberg just gave me a rather large responsibility to figure out when anti-Semitism is coming to an end. We'll see if we could get into a discussion about that a little bit. The main focus on my sources over here is not so much the reasons and origins behind it. That's really a separate discussion. What I wanted to try to focus on, well, I'll try to touch on it, was more what Scott was talking about in terms of now that it's here for the moment, how are we to respond from a Torah standpoint? And certainly we appreciate the work that Scott and others do on our behalf. And I just wanted to try to talk a little bit about historically from a Torah standpoint, a halachic standpoint, what the approach has been. And really, you mentioned 2,000 years in deicide. If you look in the Torah itself, in the written Torah, you will already find the friction between Jews and the surrounding culture very early on in our history. Explicitly in the Torah, you will find already in the days of Yitzhak, of Isaac, our forefather, when he moves to the land of the Philistines, that his success was frowned upon. They weren't too happy about it. His father, Abraham, Avram, had dug wells. The Philistines had stuffed up those wells. And then Yitzchak returned and tried to reopen them, dig other wells. He was met with a lot of resistance. The king, Avimelech, basically ran him out of town. He said, "We don't want you here. Please leave." And so he left. And then later on, the king, Avimelech, came to him and said, "Let's make a treaty." And the same thing really occurred to his forefather, Abraham, Avram. We actually read that passage on Rosh Hashanah, that Avimelech came to Avram and said, "We see you're successful. We see that God is with you. Let's make a treaty." And Avram responds and says, "Well, what are you doing about the fact that your citizens are starting up with me and are causing problems?" And really, to me, every time I read this, I always find it so ironic as I read it on Rosh Hashanah that Avimelech says, "My people, my country are causing you problems. I don't know anything about it. But let's make a treaty anyways. And, you know, history does tend to repeat itself. And that really, you go all the way back there, and if you go through some of the Midrashic and Talmudic sources, they will inform you that there are, if you read between the lines and the verses and even earlier sections, right from the get-go of the beginning of Abraham's journey to God and to spreading the word of God and the idea of a one God to the world, that he was met with a lot of resistance and aggression. He was famously thrown into a furnace by the king Nimrod, and God saved him from that, and Nimrod did try to pursue him later. So really the pushback against the idea of a nation that is spreading God's name and God's word throughout the world starts with the beginning of the founding of that nation and with the beginning of that movement that Abraham began thousands of years ago, not just from the destruction of the Second Temple. And it rears its ugly head in many forms and many ways. As we say at the Passover Seder, God has, in every generation they try to destroy us and God saves us from their hands. And the unfortunate reality is that although it takes many shapes and forms, and sometimes it's even destruction by being nice, seemingly. But in every generation, the reality is that we, as a nation, have faced these challenges. Having said that, practically speaking, let's take a look at some sources and see what the Torah has to tell us about how to deal with it. The paradigm, probably, of an anti-Semitic individual is the Esau, Jacob, Yaakov and Esau relationship. Yaakov and Esau, Jacob and Esau are brothers. Jacob buys the rights to the firstborn from his brother Esau. And then when Jacob takes the blessings that are rightfully his from his father, from Yitzchak, from Isaac, Esau is extremely resentful and he says he's going to kill Yaakov. Yaakov flees. He flees to his uncle Laban's house where he stays for 20 years. In that meantime, he marries, he has 12 tribes, and on his return to the land of Israel, he is concerned with his brother, Esau, and he sends messengers to his brother Esau, informing him that he is returning, and tries to, if you read the words of the verses, and you read as well the Midrashic interpretations and read between the lines of what's going on over there, Yaakov is trying to mollify his brother. He's trying to say that he's not looking to lord over him. On the contrary, he's willing to submit himself. And the Torah tells us that the messengers return to Yaakov, to Jacob, and they tell him, we came to your brother, to Esau, and he's coming out towards you also. He's got an army of 400 men who are coming towards you. Yaakov is very fearful, and that's where we pick up source number one. On the in the booklet over here, and here the verse says in the book of Bereshis, and Jacob became very frightened and it distressed him. And what did he do? This is the abridged version of the verses. He divided the people with him into two camps, and for he said, if Esau comes to the one camp and strikes it down, then the remaining camp shall survive. And then Jacob said, God of my father, he prays to God, rescue me, please, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau. And that is the second thing he did. And the third thing that he did, he took from that which had come in his hand. He was a very wealthy man upon his return from his uncle and now father-in-law's home. And he took a large gift, a tribute, and he sent a tribute to Esau, his brother. Okay? And these are three things that he did. He prepared for battle. He split his camp into two so that one could flee while the other fought. He prayed to God for salvation, and he sent a tribute, a gift to mollify, an attempt to mollify and to appease his brother. Okay, that's a very nice story. What does that mean? What does that mean for us? So we have an idea which comes up in numerous places, and its source is a medrash that says whatever occurred to the patriarchs is a sign for the children. Okay, in Hebrew it's often said as the term Maitza Avos Simen Labanim. What the patriarchs did is a sign for future generations. And if you have the opportunity to study through some of the commentaries on the Torah and the book of Genesis of Bereshis, you will find that history repeats itself and the commentaries talk about how whatever occurred to the patriarchs occurs again in later generations to their descendants as well. In a sense, it's the idea of the patriarchs are they are laying the groundwork, the roots of the Jewish nation. They are creating the genetic material, if you will, the spiritual genetic material, and that will develop into a full-fledged nation with all the genes therein. And so whatever they occurs to them becomes part and parcel of the spiritual body of the entirety of the Jewish nation. And so you see history repeating itself again and again throughout history. So much so that if you look at source number 3, Rabbi Yanai, who is one of the sages of the Talmud, when he would go to visit the government, probably the Roman government is generally what that refers to, he would look into the section, into this section of the Torah. He would study this entire section of the Torah to see how Yaakov dealt with Esav, to see how he should conduct himself when going to Rome. Especially because Rome is descended from Esav, from Esav. One of the descendants of Esav is singled out in the Torah as being the founder of the Roman nation. Okay, and Rome is always looked at as Esau's both physical and spiritual heirs, carrying on his ideas, his philosophy, including that dislike, hatred of the Jewish nation. And historically, Rome and the Jewish people did not exactly get along for most of the time that they were in each other's neighborhoods. Okay, that Medrash continues, actually, interestingly enough. The Medrash gives an example of how he conducted himself. That when Esav offered after Jacob appeased Esav, after he spoke to him and he mollified him, so Esav said, you know, how about if we travel together? I'll accompany you on your way back to the land of Israel. And Yaakov said, thanks, but no thanks. He kind of wriggled out of it. He said, I'll catch up to you later. And in fact, the Talmud says he will eventually catch up in the Messianic era. But he wriggled out of it, and he didn't think it was a very good idea. Even though Esav right now was friendly, didn't think it was a great idea. And so the Medrash says that Rabbi Yanai would not allow any Roman, bodyguards or individuals to accompany him. And one time he did, and he lived, thank God, but he did live to regret his action. Okay, it says that they basically took all his stuff and sold it off, and they took his property. So this is an idea. And historically, that those who are dealing with governments, other governments, would look at this section of the Torah to see how to deal with foreign governments, foreign bodies who are not necessarily your friends. I have heard, I was not there, that when Menachem Begin went to meet with Sadat ahead of the Camp David Accords, he went to visit the great, late great Rabbi Elazar Shach, who was the leader of the yeshiva world at the time, and Rabbi Shach sat down with him and studied through with him that entire section. That is what I was told. That's what I heard. I was not there. It's not videoed, but that's what they say. But this is something which is a section that is meant to be studied to learn how to deal with them. And so that brings us to source number 4, where the Ramban, Nachmanides, who had, if you know the history of the Ramban, Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman, lived in 13th century Spain. He is perhaps most famous, well, he's famous for a lot of things, but he's famous for having engaged in a famous debate in front of King James of Aragon, and he was guaranteed safety, and so he was able to speak what he needed to say during that debate with the Catholic monks who were there at the time. Although the king guaranteed his safety, and they say that the king afterwards told him he had never seen a man defend I'm forgetting the quote right now. He had never seen a man defend a cause that was so wrong so well. That is what the quote of the king was. But because of the pressure from the church at the time, eventually he was forced to leave Spain. He eventually made his way to the land of Israel, but he had his fair share of dealing with anti-Semitism during that, and dealing with governmental officials. He makes this point. He says there's another allusion in this section of the Torah for future generations, that all that occurred to our forefather, Jacob, with Esau, will occur continually to us with the descendants of Esau. Okay, more about who those descendants are in a moment. And we should take hold of the path of the tzaddik, this righteous man, our forefather Jacob, that we prepare ourselves with the three things with which he prepared himself: prayer, a gift, and salvation through war, to flee and be saved. Now let me expand on this passage a little bit, because it's fascinating, the wording, how he words it and how he expresses it. Okay, descendants of Esau, strictly speaking, would seem to be the Roman nation. There were other nations that are affiliated, but from a Jewish standpoint, traditionally, the Western world, or the Western worldview at large, is generally looked at as the spiritual heirs of Rome and of Esau's worldview, domination, power, involvement in and pleasure from this world. And that has been historically very much at odds with the worldview of the Jewish people. And that really was the root of the struggle between Jacob and Esau was, do we focus on this world or on a higher world, a more spiritual existence? And that carried on throughout history. And the Ramban tells us that these three things that Yaakov did, we have to do as well. Prayer, that's fairly straightforward. A gift, and if all else, and prepare to fight if need be. But he adds in a few words over here. He says, salvation through war, to flee and be saved. In other words, the focus on needing to fight to defend ourselves is not necessarily to be victorious, but in order to escape to live another day, basically. It's not necessarily to flex our military muscle to show how strong we are, but it's if all else fails, then you resort to fighting and defending yourself in order to flee. He is inferring this, ostensibly, because Jacob, how does the Torah express that Jacob prepared for war? He split the camp into two, and he said, if one of them is destroyed, the other one will escape. In other words, his plan wasn't necessarily to win, but rather as a last resort, that one half will stay and fight, the other half will flee. Thankfully, God helped Yaakov, and Esav was mollified with the gift, and that it never came to that fight. But the path throughout the exile, throughout the Jewish exile, generally has been not to fight if it can be avoided, but rather to try to appease the local populace, be it the local peasants, be it the government, and so on and so forth. That has traditionally been the approach. Okay, sometimes very quietly, and we'll try to focus on what Scott talked about. When do you keep your mouth shut and not say anything, and when do you make a ruckus? But quietly through back room dealings and through deals and so on and so forth, that has always been the approach throughout the exile, throughout history. Has not always saved the Jewish people from tragedy, but it has allowed the Jewish people to exist and to continue throughout history and to survive in the exile with God's help. Through that approach, it's not to necessarily get up and fight and flex your muscle unless all else fails. But the first thing is to try to give a bribe, to try to give a gift. I know today that doesn't exactly fly, at least not officially. But what goes on in back rooms is a separate. I'm still waiting for the swamp to be drained. But it's but certainly the idea, as you talk about having a good relationship with government officials, with the police department, and so on and so forth, that certainly falls under that heading of a gift and a tribute. It doesn't have to be necessarily a financial bribe per se, but it's the idea of having a diplomatic way of defending yourself, of dealing with things, of seeing the writing on the wall and being able to contact the right people at the right times and trying to avoid tragedy and avoid disaster and avoid bad things happening. And that has traditionally been one way or another, the approach of the Jewish people throughout the exile. The Talmud has many stories about it, about different things which the sages or their representatives did on behalf of the Jewish people. And even through into our days, throughout history, historically, and even as you say today, that continues to be the preferred approach based on the Torah standpoint. Does that mean that you never defend yourself and you never fight? No, it doesn't mean that. If that fails and you need to defend yourself, so then that may need to be the approach that is taken. But the first approach is certainly to turn to heaven, to turn to God and say, save us. That's the first step. And the second step is to try and through diplomatic channels, through appeasement, through mollification, to try to ease the stressors that are causing problems between the Jewish people in an area and those around them. And that really, if you look at source number 5, is the idea expressed by the Torah commentator, the Sephorno, Rabbi Avadio, of Sephorno. He says that his Esav's heart turned the moment because of Jacob's submission. And sometimes, especially in exile, that is the approach, that you have to submit. You have to bow down, you have to nullify yourself and, you know, abnegate yourself as a community before the local populace, before the local government. It's not always pleasant, and perhaps it sometimes feels humiliating, but that is the approach Jacob took when his brother came to attack him. Okay, when the Jewish people are living in the land of Israel, when there's a temple, when God is clearly with the Jewish people, you're not in an exile kind of environment, then circumstances may change as far as the approach. But Jacob's approach of exile, how to deal with our enemies in exile, that remains the paradigm today as well. Okay, that brings us. Should I pause for any questions at this point, or just keep going? Met with silence. Okay, we'll keep going then.
Keep going.
Okay. There's a fascinating passage again in the aforementioned passage of Sephorno where he says the following. If you're familiar a little bit with the era of the destruction of the Second Temple, when the Romans laid siege to Jerusalem, a section of the populace, including the rabbinic leadership, said, "Surrender to the Romans, and at least they'll spare us. Maybe they'll issue some decrees. Maybe they will tax us. Maybe they'll be upset at us for a while, but they won't wipe us out. They won't destroy the temple. They'll hopefully be appeased and mollified." And there arose a group of individuals known as the Biryonim. In English, they're called the Zealots, because that's what they kind of, the mantle that they took for themselves. They were anything but. They were basically a large group of murderous thugs who, according to Josephus, caused the deaths of more Jews during the destruction of the Second Temple era than the Romans themselves did. They burned all the storehouses of food, and they demanded that everyone go fight the Romans, and if you resisted, you were likely killed, tortured. It wasn't a pleasant situation. But they thought they were carrying out God's mission to defend the Jewish people, and they were roundly criticized by the leadership, the rabbinic leadership of the time, for destroying the opportunity of making peace with the Romans at that time. And so the Sephorno over here says that had the Second Temple zealots done this, what Jacob did to submit, our temple would not have been destroyed, as testified by Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who was the leader at that time, who went out to Vespasian. Vespasian, the initial siege of Jerusalem, Vespasian was the general. He was called away, he called back to Rome, he had been appointed emperor. And so Titus took over the lead of the army, and Titus was ultimately the one who destroyed the temple. But initially Vespasian was the one there, and Rabbi Yochanan had himself smuggled out of Jerusalem, okay, right under the noses of the zealots, a whole discussion the Talmud had to happen. And he said to Vespasian, "We want to make peace with you." And Vespasian said, "Doesn't look like it to me." And he said, "Well, these Biryonim, these zealots, are not allowing us to surrender." And the Talmud says that he really didn't have a way to, Rabbi Yochanan did not have any ideas of how to sideline, how to do an end run around these people, and ultimately it ended up full warfare and all the tragedy that came in that wake. But what he's telling us over here is, had they taken the approach of Jacob to submit to the Romans, history might have been very different. Okay? So that's, in a nutshell, the history of anti-Semitism, and the approach that we're supposed to take even today is that as much as possible not to go on the offense, but rather to try diplomatically to have good relationships with the surrounding nations among whom we live, with the government officials, with the police department, and so on and so forth, and that is really the best way. And yet, sometimes it does require some degree of submission. Perhaps sometimes it requires humiliation. But ultimately, that is the approach that was taken by our forefather Jacob, and that's the approach that's encouraged for us even today. Source number 7 is a fairly well-known statement by the great Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. The holiday of Lag BaOmer is coming up, where we celebrate his life and his passing. And Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai says, "It's a given law. It is known that Esau hates Jacob, but at this time," I'll explain what this time means in a moment, "his mercy was aroused and he kissed him with all his heart." When Jacob came to Esau with his camp and so on, the Torah tells us that Esau came to Yaakov and he hugged him and he kissed him. Okay? And there are varying opinions whether it was sincere or not. Rabbi Shimon tells us that it was sincere, if only for the moment, because historically, Esau and his spiritual heirs don't like Jacob and his descendants. Okay? So Esau does not like Yaakov, the Romans don't like the Jews. They may get along for a while, but be aware that that's a temporary situation.
The handshake at Camp David.
The handshake at Camp David, or at Oslo, for that matter. Yes. It may look good for a while, but the point that he's coming to tell us is you have to be on your guard because there are always enemies of the Jewish people lurking out there, and even if they may be very nice and they may be very kind to you and they may even be sincere, but deep down that hatred is there, and as Scott pointed out, it's not a question of whether the percentage has risen, it's a question of when it bubbles to the surface and when it does not. Okay, but the hatred among our enemies, whether they express themselves as our enemies clearly or not, but there are those out there who would love to destroy us in some form or another, and we need to be on our guard and not trust them. Unfortunately, history has borne this out. In Europe during the Holocaust, Gentile neighbors who were very good friends with their Jewish neighbors turned on them in a moment and handed them over to the Nazis, and their collaborators were all too happy to hand them over, take their homes, take their money, see them, carted off to be killed. And the fact that they had been friends for years, there were exceptions. There were exceptions. But there were many that were not exceptions, unfortunately. And that hatred is often there beneath the surface. You may not see it, but it is, but it's often there. Okay, and so that's an idea that we have to keep an eye on, again, learning from the story of Jacob and Esau, of dealing with the nations around us, is that we need to respect and suspect, as some might say. Okay, we need to build good relationships. Be a mensch, as they say. Be good citizens and try to foster a good relationship. But be careful, because you don't know really what's going on beneath the surface. And this person may be part of that, and they may not be doing anything because they're not emboldened. But you don't know what tomorrow is going to bring. There's a story with there was an Orthodox fellow who served in World War II. His name was he wrote a book called Lieutenant Birnbaum. You can get it. I believe it's put out by Arsenal Publishing. And there he talks about his life and his life as an Orthodox soldier in the United States Armed Forces. And he tells the story of a fellow, a soldier, who was a very good friend of his. And they were actually good buddies in the Armed Forces. And then one evening this fellow got himself rather inebriated. And in his drunken state, he began spewing rather anti-Semitic vitriol. And the other soldiers who were there were rather stunned that this soldier, who was such a good friend of the Orthodox, clearly Jewish, lieutenant, held these opinions. And they said, well, if that's what you think about Jews, what about your buddy over here? And he said, the classic answer, he's different. He's different. And Lieutenant Birnbaum says, and it was then I knew this is the classic anti-Semite. You know, my friend, he's different. But so you don't know what's going on beneath the surface, and that's something that we have to be aware of in exile, in dealing with the Esavs who would seek to destroy us today as well. Two more sources I have here, and that is, if you look just at source number 8, and this is a very interesting source because Scott mentioned again the idea of when do you keep your mouth shut and when do you make a fuss, when do you say something, when do you go to the media and so on. Jacob sent messengers. So I mentioned earlier that Jacob initially sent messengers to his brother. Rav Huna, the Talmudic sage, opened with the following verse from Proverbs. One who grabs the ears of a passing dog is one who passes by and involves himself in a fight not his. In English, we might say it's best to let sleeping dogs lie. And so this is the verse in Proverbs that don't pull the ears of a passing dog that's not bothering you. And Rav Huna said this is akin to what Jacob did. God said to Jacob, he, Esau, was going on his own way, and you sent messengers and said, so says your servant Jacob. In other words, Yaakov came back, and Esau was minding his own business. And Yaakov, God says to Jacob, why'd you start up with him? Why can't you just keep quiet? Now, there's a lot of discussion why Jacob did what he did. I'm not getting involved in that now. There are many different opinions. But to some degree, he was taken to task for doing this, for what we call in Hebrew, Ochez ba'ozne ha-kelev, pulling the dog's ears. Okay, he should have just left Esav well enough alone. He wasn't bothering him. And this is another very important idea throughout history. Once Esav got riled up, then we get to the rest of the discussion of how he dealt with him. But there's the idea of keeping a low profile, laying low when, if no one's bothering you, don't start up. And then the question becomes, what's the balance? When do you speak up, when don't you? When are you better off keeping quiet and not starting up? And we have to stand up for ourselves. Like I say, if I'm not for myself, then who is for me? But sometimes as in this case, if they're not really bothering you, or it's a relatively minor, perhaps, incident or something, by going to the media, by making a big deal about it, by having marches, perhaps, and so on and so forth, may not be the best approach under the circumstances. Okay, various incidents that happened over the past 75 years or 80 years during the Holocaust and the years, the following years during the plight of the Russian Jews and so on, there were always discussions over when to speak up and when not to speak up. Is this a good idea to, there was a famous rabbi's march on Washington during World War II to call attention to the plight of European Jews. There were marches during the era of Soviet Jewry behind the Iron Curtain. And there was a lot of discussion and controversy. Is it a good idea to march or not? Because are you making things worse or better by saying things? And there's always that discussion and always that tension between maybe Esau is quiet now. Maybe we shouldn't rile him up. Okay, and in fact, that was in fact the opinion of many American Jews, tragically so, because their brethren were being slaughtered in Europe, but a lot of American Jews during World War II said, we don't want to rile up the American civilization, especially because, unfortunately, the Nazi attitudes had crossed the sea to some degree to a lot of American society. And there were a lot of other leaders who said, but there are people dying. You can't just keep quiet because of your own personal position. Jews are dying in Europe. Okay, the great Rabbi Aaron Cutler, the founder of the famed Lakewood Yeshiva in Lakewood, New Jersey, he was very involved in an organization known as the Vahr HaTzalah during World War II after he fled to America, and he worked with anyone and everyone who he could get his hands on, including leaders from other what you might call movements within Judaism, and some others within the Orthodox camp weren't so thrilled that he was working hand in hand with others from other parts of Judaism. And the statement that's attributed to him is, he said, I would work with the Pope himself if it would save one Jewish fingernail. Okay, that was the quote that he said. And the point is that sometimes you have to speak up, sometimes you have to do something, but sometimes it's best to lay low. When do you speak up and when do you lay low? It depends on the situation. But there's a fascinating passage, and with this I'll end my sources over here, and we'll open up to any questions and discussion. A fascinating passage from a rabbi who was actually killed during World War II. His name was Rabbi Elchanan Wasserman. He was killed in 1941 in Kovno. Okay, he was actually not killed by the Nazis, but by the Lithuanians. And fascinatingly enough, his story was that he came to America to fundraise for his yeshiva in the late 1930s. And in 1939, on the eve of World War II, I think it was before Germany invaded Poland, but the storm clouds weren't just on the horizon. It was already thundering by that time. He got on a boat and he went back to Europe. Okay, and his supporters in America said, stay here. Why are you going back to Europe? It's almost suicidal. No one knew exactly what was going to happen, and no one dreamed what was going to happen, but they knew it wasn't a good situation. And he said, I have to go back. I have to be with my people in Europe, with my flock. And he returned to Europe, and he was arrested in 1941 and ultimately killed. But he wrote at length about what was going on in the world at that time. And I just quoted one passage over here that he says a very fascinating thing. He said, there are two modes of conduct. There are acts of God and acts of Satan. Now, please don't take this to mean that we believe that Satan is a separate power, God forbid. No. Sorry, everything ultimately traces back to God, including evil. But the question is, God empowers Satan to do things, and the question is this God giving us a kick in the pants, or is this God allowing Satan to carry out a lot of dirty work? And he says, all decrees against the Jewish people are one of these two types, and for every decree, one must determine which type it's coming from. What's the sign to make that determination? If the decree is against the physical bodies of the Jewish people, as in the days of Haman, that's an act of God, and its purpose is to return us to good. And in this case, there's no place for war, and it will not succeed. Now, I don't think he means, maybe I'm wrong, I don't think he means that you can never fight if it's a decree against the physical. What he's saying is, go back to the story of Jacob. The first mode is, you have to turn to God and pray to God and say, God, save me. And then go through the other channels with fighting being the last resort. Okay? If it's against the soul, its purpose is to cause the Jewish people to transgress, to leave their religion, okay, not to turn them back to good. That's not an act of God, but rather it's Satan empowered again by God, but it's Satan carrying out, trying to get the Jewish people to abandon their religion. And in order to weaken the power of Satan, it is required that the Jewish people be prepared to give themselves over to be killed through actual war. And he describes that that is the difference of the approach in the story of Purim with Haman and the story of Hanukkah during the time of the Assyrian Greeks. Because if you go through the stories, the story of Purim, the Jewish people did not initially fight. What did they do? They fasted, they prayed, they repented, they gathered in their synagogues. There's a decree hovering over the entirety of the Jewish nation to be wiped out. And what they did was, they turned to God and they fasted and they prayed. Once God answered them, once God showed that they had succeeded in returning to Him, then at the end, they fought against their enemies. But the first step was to turn to God, was for Esther the queen to go into the king and plead on her nation's behalf. It was the first two steps. And then, after that had succeeded, then they fought against their enemies. The story of Hanukkah, you don't find very much diplomacy going on in the story of Hanukkah. You find a small band of priests of Kohanim fighting against the mightiest army on the face of the planet. Why? Because the Assyrian Greeks sought to stamp out the Jewish religion. And so there it requires us to stand up. And what's interesting is that Rabbi Wasserman was a student of the famed Chafetz Chaim. Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan of Radin, who was the greatest Torah personality of his time, passed away in 1933, I believe. And the Chafetz Chaim said that when the communists came to power in the Soviet Union, the strongest anti-religious segment of the Communist Party were the Jewish element in there. I'm going to try to pronounce this. The Yevsektsia was what they were known as. Did I get it right? Say it three times fast. Okay. And so he said they were very strongly anti-religion, and they succeeded in stamping out religion in the Soviet Union basically for the entire duration, except for the few brave and bold who dared to stand up. But overall, there wasn't very much religion going on in the Soviet Union. And the Chafetz Chaim said that initially when this whole movement started, he said, if I would have had the strength, I would have garnered an army of people who would have come with me to fight against them. Because then we could have knocked down this power that God gave the Satan the power to wage war against religion, and we could have weakened him somewhat. But he said, the Chafetz Chaim said, I'm too weak, I'm too aged, I don't have the power for it, and history took its course. But again, the idea of when to fight, when to keep quiet, depends on the situation, and people just on their own going ahead and you know, staging marches is not necessarily the best idea. Certainly to resort to violence as a means of Jewish defense or something like that is certainly not necessarily the best approach. It needs to be carefully weighed, needs to be carefully decided by level-headed individuals, by the leadership, the Torah leadership, and the lay leadership of the Jewish people in any given situation to decide what is the best approach. Having said that, just to go back to Dr. Barenberg's question, when will anti-Semitism cease? In the Messianic era. But until that happens, we're going to have to deal with it, because you live in a world where there's a friction between what's my focus. The Esau-Jacob, the Esau-Yaakov struggle is, am I here for this world or am I here for a greater world, a spiritual existence? And as long as that struggle exists, anti-Semitism is going to exist in some shape or form. Again, it's a much broader discussion, but that's in right. 30 seconds or less.
I really didn't mean when it will cease. I doubt it will ever cease. I think it's part of the system of the world that scapegoats are always going to be required by populations. I was very glad that you struck this balance here after the mollification of Esau, that you did speak about standing up and when to hold him and when to fold him. I think even today in the modern world, the strength of Israel and the strength of the IDF and the position of Israel at the UN right now has a certain, there's an element of honor and respect for that. I think that is spreading a little bit. I'm curious to hear what other people think about that. So any questions that you might have? Please, Dick.
Well, I had a remark and also a question. The remark, it's kind of striking. It's funny, these guys are so dumb, a lot of they can't even draw a decent swastika. I mean, there's a way to draw a proper swastika.
Perhaps you want to show us that.
A proper one?
No one said they were smart.
You start on the left or on the
They're getting smarter.
But my question is, so what is the origin of the term anti-Semitism?
As I understand, it's an academic term that came up during like the 1930s as that was coming up, and it was really against the Semitic people that was there. And it was really academics, professors, people started writing on it. Yeah. As you know, that sometimes gets used against us because anti-Semitism truly means a hatred of the Jewish people, but yet the Semitic people are more than the Jewish people. So.
What was the process by which this came out? No underlying dialogue going on?
I don't think so. At all. It was just again, the earlier term had been the defamation of the Jewish people.
I think it's semantics. And
yeah,
really
it's
about
largely it. Semantics. Right. I mean, the Arab world are Semites as well,
right.
And you know.
But today we accept that anti-Semitism is a term of art that is used to describe a hatred against Jews, not just because. Not just because of the people where they're from, not because of the land of Eretz Israel, not any, it's because they are Jews. No other reason.
I've heard the term comes from a German philosopher, a social Darwinist. At that time, he's a German, which I might expect. But anyway, so he might like to refer to people in terms of this thing that eventually develops into Nazism. Of competition and survival of the fittest. And so they talk about the Semites had never referred to Arabs, though it was always about
Jews.
I don't remember what the name of it is, but I think that's the origin. And sometime in the 19th century, they had this concept called social Darwinism.
Right. And if you remember, the whole experience of the Germans and the Nazis was racial based. I mean, we've had all kinds of anti-Semitism that has flowed through different reasons why the hatred of Jews have gone, but the justification was they were this separate race, and it clearly did not mean the Arabs at the time. You're right.
Patty?
The survey
yes.
has been going on all this time. How often is it run, and how many people are usually in that?
Yeah, so the survey I was talking about that started in the mid-1960s, so it's been going on for probably 50 years now at this point in time, and we do that every 2 years. Interestingly, on our centennial celebration in 2013, we initiated the Global 100 survey, which I alluded to, and we're doing that every couple of years. It's much more expensive, but they actually survey across 100 countries, including the Middle East and North Africa. And to find out, you know, that some of these Arab countries, especially where you're going to have higher levels of anti-Semitism going on, they do it in the quantifiable scientific way that surveyors do those kinds of things. But what they found is, and I'm not going to remember the numbers exactly, but it's, you know, 25% of the world hates Jews. 75% of the world has never met a Jew. So, you know, it has that.
Shakespeare's
the other part that's kind of...
Shakespeare,
right. The other part that is interesting to me is in those studies of the Middle East, the North Africa, Iran... we should be thankful, right? It's only 50% of the people that were anti-Semites versus in Iraq and Libya and, you know, these other Middle East countries where it's, you know, 78% to 100% are going to be anti-Jewish that are there. And so the conjecture was made, and they sort of proved this out through the study, that actually to know us is to love us. And that in Iran, because there was such a long history of Jews that were in the Persian culture that was there, so many of the families knew Jews that were there that kind of helped it. But it's a really interesting phenomenon. And of course, which would take much more longer to do, today also because we have the overlay of what the state of Israel represents and how it has become a symbol that has had played into much
of
this as well.
Well, that's why I'm interested about India and China and not the Middle East, but other, you know, like the rest of the world. So is there a lot of anti-Semitism in that area?
No, not as much. I mean, there still is some underlying of it. It's a really cool, if you go to the ADL website, adl.org, www.adl.org, go on the link that says Global 100, and it brings up a map of the world, and you can scroll over each of these countries, and you can get what those results are.
You know, it's of interest that we can see why Rome and as opposing Jews, we denied Christ, and we denied that, and that denial has been part of the anti-Semitism thing.
Yeah.
But you wonder why there's such hatred among the Muslims of Jews.
Because they didn't buy into Muhammad.
Yeah.
Well, we didn't buy it, but we didn't say that we didn't kill Christ.
Denial
continuously for 2,000 years.
That's true. And in the modern area, again, we have a geographical struggle that's going on, too.
that they can tie in their animus to justify all kinds of terrible things.
And Jews spurned Muhammad.
Yes, true.
As did Christians.
But is there any element here also that we really denied Esau his birthright? And that denial maybe allowed Rome to develop and go
well,
forward?
Well, there are sources that indicate that Rome the Talmud indicates that Rome had a tradition of their forefather Esau fighting with Jacob. And the Talmud talks about a parade they would hold every year in Rome where they would make a whole display of the dominance of Esau over Yaakov after the destruction of the temple. The Arch of Titus in Rome clearly depicts that victory. You know, Jews customarily don't walk under that arch for that reason. Although there's, I'll just end with this story. I guess we're out of time. And that is, there's a story with the Ponovitcher of Rabbi Yosef Kahaneman, who after World War II lost a great deal during the war, and he came to Bnei Brak. He founded a yeshiva. People told him he's crazy. They said that you're dreaming. He said, I'm dreaming, but I'm wide awake. And the story is that he came to Rome once, and he came to the arch, and he stood by the arch, and depending on how dramatic you want to be, he screamed, or he stated, or he said, but he said, Titus, I'm here today. Where are you? Okay. The point being that ultimately, despite all the anti-Semitism and the opposition, Rome as a nation is gone. Okay, is in the dustbin of history, and we are still here and flourishing, and as we say at the Pesach Seder, through it all, God has saved us from generation to generation. So, Hashem, God should continue to protect us, and we should continue to flourish, and we'll witness the end of that anti-Semitism with the dawning of the Messianic era.
Can I just make a closing comment here?
Oh, that was my closing comment. Go ahead.
Can I award your closing comment? Okay. What was
about Christianity versus Judaism? Yeah.
I just want to carry just to close follow up on a comment that Scott said. I think that the question is here: what can we do? And Rabbi Fleischer brought sources in the Talmud how to deal with governments, also groups and individuals. But every one of us can do our part. Like Scott said, to know us is to love us. We need to make sure that's true. We need to make sure that we leave a trail that leaves an impression behind us that people say, that's a nation that I respect.
Right.
And that's a personal message.
That's good. And I often say, too, you can't both wring your hands and roll up your sleeves. And this is not the work of a day, right? So it's something we have to really continue to do. But thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Scott. Rabbi, we'll see you next week. Well done.
Thank you, Scott.
Yeah, wonderful. Nice to see
you. Muslims deny our right to land.
Land. It's more
if you look at stories.